Just a few days ago, we were at Denison University outside of Columbus, Ohio, meeting with some students and faculty and community members on the practice and how to integrate the practice even more into their educational process at the university level. And a young student had been just returned from a class in history and sociology, came into the cafeteria and was grilling me about the civil rights era. What did I know about it? What was my experience? What was my point of view on the different groups and factions and issues? And so I listened to her and I said, things are always more complicated than you think. And she said, well, my real question is there any hope? Because when I look around, I'm not sure. So from her young perspective to her quote, it seems like things have not changed. And so then she came to a meditation session that we led. And at the end of the meditation session, I walked up to her and I said, well, there's something you should remember. And she said, what's that? And I said, you are the hope. And so my friend is already in. And they've already mentioned that I have a background in the Baptist Church. So I'm just saying that in case I stand up and do something. I'm really not comfortable in a chair, to be quite honest. Though I can survive and give a dharma talk in a chair, it's not my favorite position. And so, in the New Testament, the first three books, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, all point to Jesus as the hope and tell that story. The book of John is different. The book of John raises the question and really makes the statement, and I'm going to put this in popular vernacular, Jesus did his thing. What are you going to do? That's the book of John. It's not about pointing to the light anymore. That's been done. The question is, are you willing to be the light, to embody the light? So it's not pointing to the Dharma anymore. It's not pointing to Thich Nhat Hanh or the Dalai Lama or Pema Chodron, though we can need to continue to learn from these wonderful people and many, many other teachers. But the question is, am I willing to be the hope? And if I realize that I'm willing to be the hope, that means that is an inside-out act. So the other thing I said to the young student was, quit looking outside yourself for hope. There's a Chinese Zen master who I think has one of the coolest names ever. His Dharma name is Master Empty Cloud. Now, how good is that? And I was on a trip with Thich Nhat Hanh along with many other people in China, when we were at the Nam Hoa Temple celebrating its 1500th year anniversary, and Thich Nhat Hanh was invited to give a talk, and we were lucky enough to be along with him, and we were processing in, surrounded by thousands of people, processing in to enter this temple, and Thich Nhat Hanh leaned over and said to me, "Empty Cloud taught here. You should study him." And that was almost 15 15 years ago, and so I made it, I try to follow Tai's advice. And so I've studied and continue to study Master Empty Cloud. And one of his teachings is, if you are looking for the Buddha outside of yourself, I have some very bad news for you. Only within. And then I was at a friend's house in Bloomington, Indiana, the pianist Andre Watts, who's a dear friend of ours, and he invited me over to spend a week working on my dissertation in his downstairs in a second studio next to his practice studio. So I got to spend a week with him and his dear wife while he was working on a bronze piece. I was working on my dissertation in the next room. And he was saying sort of the same thing, that you get to a point in your career where it's about you. Not in the way Miss Piggy thinks of it. But it is about you and I. We know this. But it's so easy to forget. It is so very easy to forget. I have a poem this week in anticipation, and of course I'm glad this is being recorded, because otherwise I will have no idea what I said. Because I only have notes to remind me there's a time limit. By the way, what time is this supposed to be over? That's a serious question. Okay, very good. So it seemed to us like the theme of this week is beloved community. So everything we're doing this week is about beloved community. And in preparation for the Thich Nhat Hanh tour that's coming up in the U.S. and North America this year. As you know, Tai is recovering from a serious stroke. He is now back at his hermitage in Plum Village. We just heard that in the last week, and that's wonderful news. He's very happy to be out of the hospital environment. And so are all of his attendants who are caring for him around the clock. But one of his earliest students, who we stayed with in Pasadena a few weeks ago, was saying that the tour was organized around the theme of the miracle of mindfulness. But that theme is grounded in the last conversation Thich Nhat Hanh had with Martin Luther King. And that last conversation was about beloved community as our way out, as the next stage of our development as people. And here's a poem about beloved community. Into the circle of all beings we have come, with sunshine, tree, raven, coyote, deer, rabbit, stars, and precious moonlight. May our feet walk gently in the sands of time, echoing purpose, peace, creative caring throughout this land of green. Beloved community, our heart's greatest desire, our human birthright, our destiny in every moment. It lives in our bones and minds as if a dream deferred. And yet, here we are, now, touching and being touched by its true presence. Celebrate this moment, this gathering of working dreams. I join my hands and pray that Buddhas and Bodhisattvas throughout space and time rise up from the earth at this precious hour. May these sacred energies bless us with boundless love and awaken within us our very best selves, so we may sing the songs of men and women who have come through the mist of ignorance. May we embrace the cup of compassion within our hearts as it pours out, covering the whole earth, both near and far away. May the nectar of kindness touch our lips as we speak. May we find in ourselves the vast blue sky of inclusiveness. And may our hands turn the wheel of time toward a more just world, a more beautiful world, a world worthy of our holy lives. And as I've meditated on the theme of beloved community and watched the news, and I watch all kinds of channels, you know, just to keep me from believing one point of view. And it occurred to me as I meditated that these activities we see right now, you know, this ISIS is a mantra in the media. So I was meditating on this group, and I discovered in my meditation, they are searching for beloved community. And then I thought, wow. And then we've been living in Thailand almost and working for the last 2 years almost in an international school with 800 students from 44 countries. And then coming back to the U.S. is not so easy. So again, I'm watching the news. It's like Tea Party this and Tea Party that and X Party this and Y Party that. And the rise of neo-Nazis again in Germany and Switzerland and other parts of Europe. And I thought, I meditated on it and I realized those people too are searching for beloved community. But in the Buddha Dharma way, we're able to look deeper at these searches, and I'm able to recognize wrong view of beloved community. A view of beloved community in which I am the center and you're on the periphery. A view of beloved community that condones oppression and disrespect and ignorance and violence and isolationism. And you know, this is so funny to me. It's like watching the Titanic movie over and over and over again with the crew and the captain still not getting it. It's like being on the wrong side of history. And I hear voices and I see people on the news here in the States, but around the world. And I was having a conversation with some of our Sangha friends in Thailand, and they are bemoaning their political situation there. And then we went to Myanmar for a visit, some friends. They're bemoaning their political situation. And so I said, there isn't any place on the planet that's not bemoaning its political situation. Why is that? So meditation isn't just what we do privately in terms of our own mind, our body, our feelings, our perceptions, our mental formations, etc. Meditation is also the art of looking deeply into our society. And if we dare to look into our society, what we can see right now in the social process of the whole planet. If you divide the social process for the moment into three parts, economic, political, and cultural, the economic process is dominating the entire social process the world over. and the political process is an ally to the economic process. That's why it's important. It's not making any decisions, it's following instructions. And the cultural aspect, the aspect of education and meaning and community and inclusivity and lifestyle is collapsed, generally speaking. Now, some people hear that and they see that as bad news. I don't, because what that tells me is, that tells me what my strategy should be. And that tells me my strategy should be to stand in the healing and transformation of meaning in the cultural aspects of society and spirituality and education and community, and gather the energy there and use that energy to surround the impotent political circumstance and bring economics back into balance. I'm not against economics. You know, you don't have a mining town without a mine, right? We saw an interview, I saw an interview with the BBC of a billionaire, one of the richest people in the world. And he is writing a book with the theme of the transformation of capitalism is the key to the future. And it dawned on this man, and of course people are like really angry at him. They are pissed at this guy. Because he said, you know, and what woke him up? What woke him up was Ferguson. And he said so. He realized the idea of the Horatio Alger story, which is a wonderful story. You know, somebody coming from poverty and climbing to the heights of success in society is a wonderful thing. But it is a rare thing. He realized how rare his success was when he looked at most people in the U.S. Most people, not just people in Ferguson, most people. It's like when young people come to us at our school and they want to be an NBA player. They want to play for the NBA. And, you know, the young man who is talking to me about this is like 4'10". So you wouldn't even fit into the shoes of some people in the NBA. So we have to recreate the story of what success is and how we can achieve it and how we can do it together and how it's not about my capacity to step on you so that I succeed. Martin Luther King used to have a great, great image that he would share. And it was something like, if I am standing on your neck with my foot for fear you might get up, how far can I go? We got to wake up, people. Our story is about what it means to be human. Are going through change. That's why you're here. You've been going through this process. And this process is in fact increasing around the planet. Except none of it reported in the mainstream. So everything is kind of like positive. Is categorized as fringe, marginalized, not really meaningful to the main course. And this is true around the world. Just listen to conversations. I listen to people's conversations. And one of the things in the Buddhist tradition is the four nutriments practice of edible food, sensory impressions, volition or intention, and consciousness. And Thich Nhat Hanh asked me once to give a little talk on the nutriments, and I focused in on sensory impression. And I did that after I studied the Columbine event, and interviews with the children associated with the young people who perpetrated that tragedy. And the questions were, was this because of video games? Was this a result of TV programming? Was this was? And like 9 out of 10 of the kids said, no, this is because of conversations we had. There's also a great movie on the history of the Nazis and the 7% solution, et cetera, et cetera. And it's all in the framework of the conversations people had. So if you feel like you're losing hope, pay attention to the conversations you're having and who you're having them with. You know, you can walk out of a movie. Just because you paid for it doesn't mean you have to stay through it. If it's not nourishing you. Rick Hansen, who I had the pleasure of spending a day with a couple of weeks ago in San Francisco, the neuroscientist and therapist, who Peggy is also embodying his work, he calls it anchoring the good. What we have to do is train ourselves to anchor our experiences of goodness, our experiences of kindness, our experiences of trust, our experiences of wholeness, our experiences of being in beloved community. We're not going to get into the news tonight. Not unless one of us does something really horrible. But this kind of gathering is going on all over the world. You should know that. And I have the good fortune of having friends and colleagues all over the planet who write me, share stories about the incredible things people are doing. Wonderful things. And so I make sure that's what I hear. So if I do 1 minute of CNN, I do 10 minutes of my friends. Okay? I won't even go into Fox. Except to say it's an example of what William Irwin Thompson, MIT character who became a spiritual awakened person, wrote a book, several books, but one of them was, he pointed out something he called the sunset effect. And he was saying there are periods of time when history is changing, when things are really changing. And there's a period, if you look out on the horizon, there's a moment in which sunrise and sunset appear to be exactly the same to your eyes. But one is setting, and the other one is opening a new day. So I look at the negativity I see in the media and reactivity I see in groups as sunset effect. These are states of consciousness that have recognized they're on the wrong side of history, and they're trying to hang on before the party's over. But as my grandmother used to say, the party is over. And you need to know when, so you can move on. Don't let somebody grab your hope from you. Steal your hope from you. Twist your hope into doubt about your own capacity to wake up. Doubt about your neighbor's capacity to wake up. To be kind. To be loving. To be respectful. To be creative. Evolution is not over. I know this may surprise some people. And it really would only surprise people who haven't looked very much into the details of Darwin's work. Darwin never said evolution was over. That wasn't his research. He did the best he could to identify what he was working on from an academic perspective. I know it's easy to think. You know, we took, a lot of people took Darwin's work. Now, the human species, Homo sapiens, we are the pinnacle of evolution. Okay? We are all that. And you know, I know we have Priuses and cable TV and iPhones and wireless this and that, which is fine. But 10,000 years ago on the planet, there was not a person with blue eyes, as far as we know. That's an evolutionary development in the last 10,000 years. 11,000 years ago, most Europeans were brown, browner than they are now. That was a 10,000 year development. Some evolutionary psychologists have identified, along with neuroscientists, 200 changes that are occurring right now in our nervous system, in our brain. All inside. You know, we're not growing a third ear or extra fingers. It's happening inside. The amount of serotonin our bodies are now having to produce to deal with discontinuity of our experience of being human. Look at how many commercials there are on insomnia. There's a whole industry, a sleep industry now. Or our neurochemicals that have to do with our mood. Our body can barely produce enough. And when you start to understand that, you can start to understand some of the drug issues from a different point of view. We are trying to cope with the crisis of human evolution that's happening inside of us, brought on by the modern world. One of my friends is a professor from China, and she is noted, and she's working on a book now on mindfulness for the Chinese market. And what she found out from her family, who still lives in China, her dad's a professor, her mom's an artist, etc., but that the more developed, quote unquote, the Chinese culture has become, there's almost a parallel pattern of an increase in mental illness. When we were in Vietnam with Thich Nhat Hanh one time, we were out in the villages that we support in schools and things, and there was a young man who had just got a new job in a factory in Hanoi, and no longer based in the village, and so we were having a conversation with him. And it was like, what did you used to do? He said, well, I used to be a buffalo boy. I used to get up early in the morning and gather the buffalo and take them out for food and take them out for their walk. And then I'd bring them back and then I'd give them all their bath, along with my other friends who were buffalo boys. And then we would sing some songs, write a few poems. Then we'd go around the village and see who was sick and who we needed to care for. Was anybody need, you know, we needed to make soup for or take care of? And then I'd go home and maybe write a few poems. And so I said, well, you know, what's life like now? He said, well, I have enough money to have a radio, and I'm saving money to get a new motorcycle so I can travel. But I don't write poems anymore. I don't visit the sick people in my village anymore. I'm too tired when I'm home from the factory. And I'm not saying we shouldn't have factories. I'm saying we should be wise about how we do these things. There's a lot of changes in society and in the human psyche that literally can be traced to the Industrial Revolution. And lots of people have researched this. So you don't take my word for anything. Do your homework. I always try to do mine. Evolution is not over. And in neuroscience, we have For a long time, we thought, by the time you were 15, your brain had developed all it was going to develop. Literally, you were not going to get any more brain cells, nothing was, everything was fixed. And it was only recently we discovered that the adult brain can change. Wow. Because so for a long time, a lot of us have been getting by on this old story. You can't teach an old dog new tricks. So it's like, well, I can't learn that. Well, I went to a PhD program late in life, which is not something I'd especially recommend, especially when you have to study Sanskrit and Pali and Chinese. So, but I had to break through that story. I can't learn this. Because we do know that it's very easy for children to learn languages quickly at younger ages. So, I had to work it. I had to change my story about my own brain and my own mind. And I discovered I could through the practice. So now we know that meditative practice can actually impact the shape of your brain, the structure of your brain. Sarah Lazar, a brilliant young lady from MIT, did a research project on how meditation practice over 8 weeks began to thicken the cerebral cortex. Why is that important? It's important because naturally, as we age, our cerebral cortex gets thinner. So she was saying to me, if you really want to get people interested in meditation, so it is anti-aging. Because the more solidity we have in our cortex, the more effective our memory works. For example, Eileen Luders from UCLA discovered in her research that meditation over a certain period of time, long-term meditators, that the functionality between the communication between the right and left hemisphere is improved. Clarity of thought, speed of thought, depth of thought, all improved. And these were adults, these weren't college students alone doing these practices. There's so much now on this, the power of contemplative practice to change our neurological way of being. And the Buddhism has known this for a couple thousand years. And the way we've talked about it is that the mind becomes pliable as we learn to meditate. We learn that the mind is a pliable, the mind is a living organism that can change. And in many cases in the West, people have gotten kind of get oriented to the awareness part of meditation. We've become aware of how our mind's working, and we're working on shamatha practice and calming. We're gaining insight into the processes that are going on in our own mind. In mind, remember, mind doesn't mean intellect. Mind means heart. One of the great phrases from early Buddhism in Vietnam is the cave of the heart is what the mind is. The mind is our dispositions, inclinations, conditionings, many, many. Of course, the Heart Sutra would say the mind is empty. It is full of everything. You know that already. But we can also shape our mind. Being aware of our mind is one kind of development of skill in meditation. But we can also actually shape our own mental experience. And therefore, we can, just like we reshape our brain, we can reshape our own mind. We can create our own experience of healing and transformation. And the sutras are full of those techniques and the commentaries, etc. And then third, of course, is we can liberate our mind. That's more tricky, of course, because it's really easy to get comfortable with the awakening process once we practice for a long time. It's another Chinese master, Wei Ning, gave a talk once about what's hard for beginners in meditation and what's hard for old hands. I think it was Wei Ning. It could be Empty Cloud again. These Chinese guys really have some great stuff to teach. And which Thai is all studied, of course, but it says, for beginners, the challenge of learning to meditate, of learning to work with your mind, is noise. There's a primary external noise and internal noise. So the beginner is having to, you know, the first time you remember, if you're not a beginner or if you are a beginner, the first time you sit down to do meditation, and it was like, whoa! Somebody turned that radio station off. There's a bunch of crazy people in my head. Noise. Okay? And then over time, it becomes background, and then fades and fades and fades and fades. But as that happens, it's very easy then to become comfortable. This is his other point. So you know when you become comfortable in the practice because you know exactly where your cushion is supposed to be. You know exactly how to walk from the door to that spot. You know exactly how to position your zabuton, your water in some cases, which always bothers me. But anyway, and you know how to settle into your posture. And that's wonderful. And must continue. However, he says, we who can do that, we are fit, we have become fit for silence. We can handle silence. However, it's entirely possible we can walk out of the Zendo and into the parking lot and be completely pissed off in 30 seconds. We're fit for silence, but not for chaos. That's the next stage, to be fit for chaos. We're staying with Vera, and she's got like two pictures of the tango up in her house. Dancing. Learning how to dance, learning how to be with life as a living, dynamic, ever-changing, so that we don't have to be caught in the constructs we were given. You know, they're all constructs. Society is nothing but a mental expression. And this is why, you know, people who think Buddhism does not have social consequences, let's just keep that a secret. Okay? Until it's too late for them to do anything about it. Because once you realize, oh my, I don't have to think like that. I don't have to deal with my emotional experience like that. I can decide. I can choose. I can be wise. I can nourish myself. I don't have to be addicted to anger or sadness or fear. I'm really struck by how afraid people are here in the U.S. Just, you know, I just came from Thailand, and we're having a coup, right? But I saw more guns in the L.A. airport when I arrived than I did my whole time in Thailand. I kid you not. There's a book that came out 4 or 5 years ago called One Nation Under Fear. If you haven't seen it or read it, do it. And that's natural. Our amygdala, the part of our brain, the reptile, part of our brain that keeps us safe and is on guard, right? Keeps getting bigger and bigger because we're feeding it. And there's some media systems whose names I'll not mention, who I don't know how anybody can even hold their head up, their amygdala has gotten so large from feeding fear and anxiety. And what we know about meditation and contemplation and deep practice is that it actually recirculates the energy from the amygdala and transforms it into the pathway of higher function. Meditation practice is not innocent. It's not just about being calm. It's not just about being nice, though please continue to do so. It is about understanding that we create our world. Carl Jung, after World War II, was interviewed, and out of the interview came a great book called The Undiscovered Self. And it's a small book for any of you who don't like to read. It's worth reading. It's not too many pages. And in it, he says something like, it's really important for individuals to know that they are the pivot point, not institutions. Not structures. Individual consciousness is the pivot point in change and transformation in society. Peggy and I were in Plum Village some years ago on our way back from Plum Village to California when this guy, this nut, tried to smuggle a shoe bomb on an airplane. And we heard about this in Plum Village before we left. And so I turned to Peggy and I said, I bet all of us are going to have to take off our damn shoes from now on. And we got to Charles de Gaulle, and there it was, shoes on the conveyor belt going through x-rays. Because some idiot. I'm also from Cleveland, and I'm getting old. I don't have time to screw around with a bunch of stuff. Right? I don't have to be nice like Thich Nhat Hanh does. Or the Dalai Lama. I mean, they're culturally conditioned to be nice. Well, it's true. Asian society is much nicer. Right? And then, because this is not their land, they're especially nice. But I'm home. So it's just like, cut the bullpen. No, let's get to this. We have everything we need to transform ourselves and this world. Our children in our school in Bangkok, as I mentioned, 800 of them, growing and growing, 44 nationalities, they don't know they're not supposed to get along. They don't. They don't know they're supposed to hate each other, have conflict, beat each other up, attack one another, or compete to the point of harming somebody else to get ahead. In fact, they end up helping each other do homework. So the kids who are good at math volunteer to help the kids who are not. And everybody is excelling. And you can get an award for something, and everybody applauds for you. It doesn't matter that I didn't get the award. What matters is, I know someone who did. This is shared joy. This is part of the Brahmaviharas. This is a hard practice, being happy because somebody else is happy. But our experience, often, and this is part of our conditioning, though, culturally, socially, part of our politically conditioned. We lived in a condo in Bangkok that had a lot of dogs in it. One of our neighbors had a Chihuahua. And part of the thing about dogs in Thailand, this is also true in Japan, but especially people love to dress up their dogs. Okay? We promised our dog we would never do that. But people love to dress up their dogs. So I'm sitting in the lobby and there's this little tap, and this is the sweetest woman you never want to meet, right? I have this tap on the shoulder, I turn around, and she puts this dog in my face, and it has on a full leather pilot's jacket, a World War II pilot's cap, and red goggles. And I just lost it. That is so funny. So anyway, she's there with her dog. I go upstairs to get our dog Charlie to take him out for a walk. And we come down to the lobby, and her little Chihuahua turns into the Hulk. It goes berserk, running and barking and literally foaming. And she turned to me and said, "Jealousy dog." So I promised some people I'm going to write a book. That'll be one of the chapters. Now, a lot of what we have labeled, I discovered this through my own life and practice, racism, sexism, homophobia, adultism. You know about that, right? You know how the world is made for adults? And children are appendages, often irritating appendages. And voiceless. And you know, I can keep going with the isms. There's an abundant supply. But one of my insights is that connected to some of these is literally jealousy dog. A really base human emotion. And you know, Buddhism is one of the few spiritual traditions that will bring that one out on the table. It's one of the reasons I respect it so much. There's a Dharma teacher who came to Santa Barbara when we lived there and did a whole weekend retreat on jealousy. Nobody invited her back. So in Yogacara Buddhism, when people say things like, or when we have the experience, when we have the thought, "I thought we dealt with this already." I know you've had that thought, right? I thought we were over this. What's up with the police just going crazy? You know, I was 2 years in Thailand, I have to tell you the truth. Not one moment did I ever have an image or a thought come through my head about being shot by anybody. And I was in a foreign country, in a coup. Not one thought of it. And the emotional energy it takes to deal with that thought. Okay? So in coming back here and moving back here to the U.S., the moment I got off the airplane and went into LAX, I noticed how my energy. So I was about 17 years old when I realized why I was pissed as an African American man. And what I realized was how much of my life energy I had to use every day to make other people not scared of me, not afraid of me, able to be with me. And I'm just using my energy and using my energy, and sometimes not a lot came back. And that gets to you. And fortunately, I found the practice. So now I know how to transform energy in me, transform energy coming at me, so that I retain my sovereignty. And that's what the practice is for each of us, to retain our sovereignty.
Thich Nhat Hanh says we have to learn to be the queen and king of our own internal territory and not let it be hijacked, ripped away from us, torn away from us. It doesn't mean things aren't difficult. It doesn't mean there aren't difficult people. It does mean, here's a story. We used to live in Boise, Idaho. Shortly after we were married there, someone bombed our house. And I had consulted with the Miami Police Force on some issues previously, and the police force in Boise knew this, and so I was invited to go visit the chief and have a chat about our house being bombed. And when I went in, we sat down in his office privately, and he said, I need your enemies list. And I said, I don't live with one of those. That's not the way I live my life. I don't create that for myself. And then he says, okay, well, we have an idea who it was. It was the Aryan Nation in northern Idaho, because they've done that to other interracial couples in the state. So fortunately, after this happened, we were already scheduled to go to Plum Village for a long retreat. So we went, we sat down with Ty, we told him what happened, and Thich Nhat Hanh basically said this horrible, terrible, and wanted to know how our dog was, and et cetera, et cetera. Very sweet. And then he said, basically, you know, this is an indication of how much work we still have to do. So I get busy. And so then, and this, you know, it was a traumatic experience. So, and Peggy was in the house when the bomb hit. I was consulting in California and got the phone call. But as soon as I got there, for 2 years after that, every time I smelled smoke, all those images, all that anxiety, all that fear, energy, all that came back. And fortunately, with the practice, I knew how to do alchemy with it. So I decided I was going to go deeper. And so I decided the topic of my meditation was going to be Aryan Nations. So I calmed myself, calming, serene, peaceful. And then I took a look with the question of who joins this group. And my motivation was the question, why would somebody try to kill me? If they didn't know me, if they knew me, I might understand. And so when I looked into this group, you know what I found out? I found out most of the people in that group were under 25. Most of the people in that group hadn't gone or finished high school. Most of the people in that group were poor. Most of the people in that group grew up in a family environment where they were physically, emotionally, and sometimes sexually abused. And what happened to me when I did that is I realized the suffering that conditioned someone else's unskillful behavior toward me. I'm not, and so I told the police chief, I'm not saying don't lock these clowns up. Find them and lock them up and help them get on a new path. But I am saying what that did for me was it kept that event from controlling my psyche. It kept that event from determining my internal life for the rest of my life. I could spend the rest of my life about that. Eating up my energy, eating up my vitality, eating up my creativity. But when I touch somebody else's suffering, this is what Thich Nhat Hanh means and other teachers mean when they talk about compassion. Compassion is not sympathy. It's understanding the conditions of suffering. And when you understand the conditions of suffering, that is not a process of decision making. It's just a process of understanding to protect your own heart and your own mind. So, in order to be the hope that you are and not give up, be wise about who you have conversations with. And if you have to have a conversation with someone that you know, 2 minutes into this, you're going to feel bad. You're going to feel bad about yourself, or you're going to feel bad about them, or you're going to feel bad about the world, or your neighborhood, or your children. Then control the length of time of that conversation. If just unavoidable. Okay, so I have no problem saying to people, I only have 3 minutes. Right? Hey, I only got three. But for that 3 minutes, you have my undivided attention. Okay, but I'm not going to lay down in this mess. Okay, or make sure you have people who uplift you when you hang out with them. I mean, that's part of what Sangha is. You know, spiritual friends. This is early teachings from the Buddha. But so many of us have spiritual friends for an hour a week and then unspiritual friends for the rest of the week. So if you want to know why you're sometimes a little tired, a little upset, look at your conditions and your conversations. Nourish what's good. One more comment about that from a neuroscientific point of view. What we've discovered in neuroscience is because our brain is wired, our nervous system is wired to protect us, and fortunately it does do its best to do that. That also means it retains what is negative immediately and puts it in the hard drive. And what's positive bounces off like Teflon. So in order to nourish yourself fully, this, and I'm talking about practice, when you have a wonderful experience in meditation practice and you're sitting or walking or in the Sangha, stay with that for a while. It takes 5 times as much effort to retain a positive experience as it does a negative. That's neuroscience on our brain. In Yogacara Buddhism, there's a concept of transformation at the base of consciousness. So I'm coming back to when we have these experiences of, oh, I thought we changed that, or we haven't come as far as I thought. We've come a long, long way, believe me. But these reactions we're seeing in ourselves and in others is because we're at the threshold of the base of our consciousness changing. And that's why people are going crazy with really weird stuff. Have you ever? I mean, it's just incredible. I see some things and I hear some things. It's like, what? So this is learning to practice with chaos and change and giving ourselves the possibility of transformation at the base of our consciousness, because the opportunity we have in this room that no other human beings have ever had like this is we actually can reinvent human nature. What an opportunity we have. Okay. We have 4 here. And I'll read all 4, and then we'll respond. Thich Nhat Hanh says the next Buddha is Sangha.
Thank you.
What from your experience is the most useful practices or the Dharma in relationships? Actually, on Monday, the Sangha on Monday, we're going to be sharing the Buddha's teaching on the six harmonies, is the language for the best way to have harmony in relationships. Now, it's important, in my view, to not misunderstand what harmony means. Harmony does not mean suppression. Harmony does not mean there aren't difficulties. Presbyterian pastor and theologian, Dietrich Bonhoeffer, who was hung for participating in a plot to assassinate Adolf Hitler, wrote a great book on Christian community. And I think the same thing is important for Buddhists to realize. A Sangha is a real community, not a perfect community. And please say more, Pig, about that question.
No, that was good.
Okay. So as a POC with a history of needing to use my energy to deal with racism, racist comments, how is the best way to transform my own negative energy without ignoring the racism? Well, that could be a whole retreat, but of some duration. But I would say, and I mean that seriously, and I mean that for all of us. So the first thing I would say is, what's really important in the context of beloved community is that we all need to understand racism. And we all need to understand how to deal with this energy because it is pervasive. And it affects all of us, not just some of us. That's one of the great insights of Martin Luther King. So first of all, I have a spiritual practice in the mornings that I do before I leave, that I create a, and that's gonna sound like one of the Avengers here, but I create this field of energy around myself that protects me from other people's negative energy. And somebody asked me, well, how'd you learn to do that? Well, actually, I learned to do that growing up in Cleveland, Ohio, in the general. I did. And what I learned was, if you have, I could get a group of people to walk away from me 10 feet by how I did work with my own energy and how I walked down the street. So part of how you deal with other people's negativity is you protect yourself energetically. Then there is one of the greatest lies ever told. You've heard it. Sticks and stones may break my bones, but words will never hurt me. Now, who came up with that? It's not true neurologically. It's not true emotionally. There's no evidence that words do not hurt people. Words cause wars, for example. Verbal abuse is now a real category. In schools, bullying, on and on and on, verbal abuse. So, then what I do, if it gets under my skin, if it gets past my shields and really gets to be irritating, then what I've learned to do is, one, I do walking meditation. I've learned to be able to take something that hit me emotionally and walk with it. And while I'm walking with it, I am trying to honor it. What I mean is, I am trying to respect my own experience. I'm not pretending that truck did not run over me. So I'm acknowledging, and then I'm embracing my own suffering. And sometimes this takes a while. You know this from your own experience. Sometimes it takes a while to be able to be with your own suffering, to recognize it, acknowledge it, and embrace it. But then when we are able to recognize it, acknowledge and embrace it, then what I have learned to do, this is again through the benefit of the practice, I have learned that my pain is not the only consciousness I have access to. I also have access to my compassion, my hope, my love, my joy. And whichever one of those will help me envelop that pain, so that pain does not define me. It's a part of my experience, but it is not the definition of my life. It is not the definition of my human journey. And as I'm able to hold that, that's what I did with the Aryan Nation. It took 2 years, but that's what I did. I was able to hold my own pain with compassion for myself first, because if it isn't at home, it can't leave the house. Okay? You have to be able to come and hold yourself in compassion. So if you cry, cry. You shake, shake. Be with your experience. It's authentic human experience. But then, don't let that experience be the sole definition of who and what you are. That's how I've learned to deal with and do the alchemy. And I get help when I need it. I go ask other people. I go to a sweat lodge. I go to a Mount Shasta retreat center in silence for 7 days. I do different kinds of spiritual practices that help me keep accessing different aspects of my consciousness to work with my experience. So like I try to say to some new people who have come to Buddhism, just because you meditate doesn't mean you don't need a dentist. Or a doctor, or a therapist, or a plumber, or, you know, we have people like this. Meditation isn't supposed to, it's not a tool to solve problems. It's a path of healing and transformation. This is another question that looks like it's for moi. What was the switch that took you from an angry 17-year-old to realizing your work of alchemy? It was the assassination of Martin Luther King. I'm crystal clear about that. My mother said it this way. You were quiet for 17 years. And the day after Dr. King got assassinated, you started speaking. That was it. I mean, that was. Can you say a bit more about the alchemy of fear? How can we bring gentleness to ourselves in that practice? One of the things, our topic for our retreat in Columbus last week was on the Heart Sutra. And we were looking at Thich Nhat Hanh's new translation of the Heart Sutra. And I was comparing that with a Heart Sutra from originally in Sanskrit from 8th century, and so that people could see, you know, Thich Nhat Hanh is not making this stuff up. There's a history to Buddhism, there's a lineage to the tradition, it has roots, it has lots of energy, thought, and practice, and discussion in its history. And it's that sutra is all about the alchemy of fear. And how we can bring gentleness, how I've learned to bring gentleness, and I keep learning this. Everything I'm talking about, I am continuing to learn Okay, so let's be clear about that. There's a concept in Buddhism which I really like that really helped me understand this. And the concept is called I making. Letter I, making. And what I mean by I making is Miss Piggy. If we go through our life in which everything is about moi, then everything is about moi. Fear, happiness, loss of happiness, fear. So if we identify our identity around that energy, and fear is an energy, it's a real energy, but it's just an energy. It's no more of an energy than hope. It all depends how much energy we give to that energy, how much power and control over our when I used to consult with Hewlett Packard, people would come out of a meeting and say, oh, I don't have any more mind space for that. How much mind space we give to these energies in our life? Fear, hope, anxiety. And so, you know, you can like think of it as a bell. And you know, if you want the whole bell filled with fear, it'll do that. But you don't have to do that. Fear can be in the bell along with happiness, along with sadness, along with surprise, along with the dynamic nature of being human. So what I learned is I don't have to take one of my experiences and make it the whole definition of my human existence. That human existence is complex and very interesting. So I try to stay interested. And then, you know, you can practice with this. If you go to the Sutra on the Four Foundations of Mindfulness, there's a whole sequence of steps you go through. So if I'm having fear, if I'm experiencing fear, first thing I do is I am honest about my experience. I come home to myself. And after I am home to myself, and I can touch that and know how it's touching me, then I begin to look at the conditions that created it. How did this fear come to be? So when we're sitting in meditation and learning to watch the arising of our breath, the dwelling of our breath, and the disappearance of our breath, we are training ourselves to be able to do that with every experience, not just the breath. So, fear rises, it's here, and then it disappears. Well, what were the conditions that caused the fear to rise? Okay, and there could be a combination of conditions. And then once I start to recognize the conditions, then I can ask myself, in what way could I shift those conditions? Or in what way have I participated in those conditions? So you don't give your power away. And then, this is how you get past I-making. Then you can ask yourself, look outside of yourself and say, are there other people experiencing fear? And what conditions are they living in? And then you get to be human, but your experience becomes universal, not just personal. That's part of the alchemy. I think there may be one more. Why don't you do that one?
You're really on a roll.
Yeah.
I really hate to interrupt the flow.
No, you're doing great. if you can answer this one, or any of the ones, any of the others, as far as I'm concerned. Because this is part of it. When you are in a sangha with somebody, in a marriage with somebody, this is part of the relationship question again, a neighbor with somebody, a brother and sister with somebody, When they get hurt, you get hurt. Now, there's something we in the trauma world, we call secondary trauma. Witnessing somebody else's pain. And many of us get damaged by witnessing other people's pain. And there's now techniques and methods that we've learned in connecting to our own tradition, but also in trauma training, to help people deal with secondary relationship impact.
Okay, well, I've got two. I'll be quick. Thich Nhat Hanh says the next Buddha is the Sangha. That's correct. What, from your experience, is the most useful practice of the Dharma in relationships? And have you decided where you will be based? These are connected. On the one hand, one of the reasons they're connected is that teaching and offering the Dharma brings out the best in me, and it brings out the best in my husband. And so I'm really enjoying that he has this opportunity. And that's a useful practice of the Dharma relationship, is to know what your loved ones love and to help celebrate that in them. And that's what we found with sanghas, is to have less meetings and more celebration. Take more time to appreciate each other and celebrate. And yeah, you got to have some meetings, but cut back on the meetings and have you celebrated. Same with your partner, have you celebrated. And this is connected because we're going to be based on Whidbey Island. At this chapter of our life, we wanted more support from a Sangha. And so we put out feelers to different parts of the country. And we've been really impressed with the support we've received from Seattle and Whidbey Island. Our current editor that's helping Larry finish is from Seattle. We have Vera's Place, we have Sangha support, and on Whidbey Island, we think we have a big barn for teaching, really big barn. We've got people coming to help us do some barn raising to fix it, but we intend on settling in this area, and that's partly out of my husband's love for me. Larry was more in love with Thailand than I was. And so this is connected that way too. So you'll make me very happy to continue to support my husband and to help us do what we really love, which is to support the Buddha Dharma Sangha. We feel really blessed to have found our calling in life and really lucky to have found such a teacher so many years ago. You know, we were so lucky I met Thich Nhat Hanh right after I was widowed. Within like a month of being widowed. And Thich Nhat Hanh married us then in 1994, and also was so helpful for us as we've had some of our deep practice experiences. But we're gonna be here, and I hope to get to practice with you all. And I'm really flying in here and seeing the mountains and seeing the water and seeing the trees. Bangkok, I'm a country girl, and I'm a lake girl, and living in Bangkok has been very difficult for me. I was having a really difficult day, and I discovered on our windowsill next to our bathroom, a dove couple had made a nest, eye level, right by my window. So the last 2 months I was in Bangkok, I watched her sitting on that nest, and that was as close as I got to nature in Bangkok. It was this bird that came to me. So I'm just really grateful to be here, and thank you for listening so intently and for supporting us and supporting any Dharma teacher. We're always looking for people to ask us to teach. So I just really appreciate you. Thank you.